Evidence and Answers begins right now. This is Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukeran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. Have the teachings of Jesus been accurately preserved, or were they changed over time? Can we really trust the New Testament when critics point to oral tradition, anonymous authors, and alleged contradictions in the gospel accounts? Today, we welcome theologian and apologist, Dr. Ben Shaw, author of Trustworthy, 13 Arguments for the Reliability of the New Testament. We will examine the historical reliability of the New Testament and whether we truly have the authentic teachings of Christ. Stay tuned. You won't want to miss this fascinating and important conversation. Now, on to part one of this two-part interview entitled Trustworthy, 13 Arguments for the Reliability of the New Testament.
You're listening to Evidence and Answers, where we provide compelling evidence for faith and hope in Christ and biblical answers to the issues of today. Well, is the New Testament historically reliable? Do we have the actual teachings of Jesus or someone's interpretations of Jesus' teachings? Weren't the gospel writers biased? Wasn't Paul biased? Weren't the teachings of Christ passed down orally until they were finally written down decades later? So how accurate is the oral tradition? Don't we have contradictions in the gospel accounts? Can we trust the New Testament? Well, here to address several of these questions is Dr. Ben Shaw. Ben serves as the president of Core Apologetics. He has an MA in religious studies at Liberty University, and he's the author of the great book that we are endorsing here, Trustworthy, 13 Arguments for the Reliability of the New Testament. So, Ben, welcome to Evidence and Answers.
Hey, Pat, thanks so much for having me. Excited we get to talk and chat here for a little bit.
Yeah, we met at the Southern Evangelical Apologetics Conference, so it's great to have you on our show. You work closely with one of our mentors and a guy we've had. He's on about a dozen shows here on Evidence and Answers, Dr. Gary Habermas.
Yeah, that's awesome. He's done a great job of really helping us all understand the resurrection that much better.
Well, tell us about your background, Ben. How is it you came to faith in Christ and how you got into this arena of apologetics?
So it started with my babysitter took me to church when I was younger. And I heard the Sermon on the Mount, and then I just recognized Jesus as Lord as I was hearing the Sermon on the Mount, especially the part about loving your enemies and praying for them. I was like, oh, that is, yeah, even sinners can be nice to sinners who are nice to them. But to be nice to someone who's treating you harshly is a different thing altogether. But I was pretty young then, didn't really get discipled, but God had oases for me along the way. So I went to a Lutheran middle school, public high school, and then a Catholic high school. So I kind of bounced around there a little bit. But I ended up going to Catholic high school because they had a hockey team and I wanted to play ice hockey. So that was one of the things that was driving me at that time. And I was wrestling with a bunch of questions. I'm from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And I had a number of questions about God as I was growing up, but I didn't have anybody really to talk to or to ask these questions about. So I just held them internally. But I also saw 4 million other people in our county with 4 million different views. And how was I going to know who's right, who's wrong? That's overwhelming. Where do I begin to start with all that? And so I kind of just, you know, you can either go, everyone's always like, everyone's right. And that kind of relativism kind of thing. Or you can just get really cynical and be like, everyone's wrong and we can't know anything. I thought I was being gracious. And I was like, okay, maybe we're all right in our own way or something like that. So, but it was quite unlivable. I also saw a number of people around me pursuing things of this world and saw the vanity of that. So I struggled with meaning, questions of meaning and value. Hockey helped with a lot of that is what I'm getting at. And so I started playing hockey and I played it every single day about when I was 15 or so, which is pretty late to start. But I ended up living in Connecticut for a few years. I wanted to be really good because I thought it would help me find a wife as well. So a lot was depending on it. But I ended up playing 3 years in Connecticut. Wasn't really thrilled about trying to continue to play up there. Went back to Florida. I played at FAU for a year and was still kind of wrestling. I was going to church, but just wasn't, I was waffling. Waffling's a great way to put it. Because I didn't have any anchor. I was getting tossed here and there by every wind of doctrine coming my way. And someone told me about Liberty, and I was like, well, that's good, but I can learn about God in Florida. The weather's nicer here, so I'm good. But then they told me they had an ice rink on campus, and I applied the next day. So then I ended up going to Liberty just because they had a hockey team. It was the only reason I went there. And if they didn't have the rink, I wouldn't have gone. But when I was there, my first couple of years, I went as a business major. My idea was to be a law enforcement officer, and I was told to get a business degree in case something happens, you got to fall back. And so, whatever. Yeah, I wasn't there for the school. I was there for hockey, but that was kind of my bigger plan. But while I was there, I met Dr. Habermas, but I met him as the hockey coach because he was one of the first hockey coaches of Liberty. And then from that, I was like, that's nice to meet you. I hope we're going to do better now that I'm on the team. That's kind of, you always want to be better when you're there. But my senior year, I took a class called Christian Evidences, and we read Case for the Resurrection that Habermas wrote with Lacona. And I'm like, why is the hockey coach writing a resurrection book? What's this about? And then I came to find out it was the hockey coach was a resurrection guy, not the other way around. So I got to ask him some questions, and I realized if I want to go be law enforcement and I want to help people, because that was my idea, not only do I need to learn jujitsu, so I started doing that, but I also need to learn more about God so I can help people, because I can't help anybody. I mean, people have some serious problems, and God's the one who has the answers for them. So I needed to learn more about that. So then I ended up getting a master's and then being able to study with Doc for like over a decade, doing resurrection research. So that's how I got kind of connected and into this whole world.
Yeah. Well, we got similar backgrounds. I came to Christ in high school and I was playing football, baseball, and golf, but realized golf was the ticket to collegiate sports for me.
Interesting.
And yeah, I picked Point Loma University because they were a Christian college. That's what I wanted. And the only one on the West Coast with a golf team. And so that's why I ended
Oh.
up there and things. I want to play golf with a bunch of Christians. But I ended
Yeah.
up being the only Christian on the golf team. So anyway, but that's the only reason I went to Point Loma, because I just
Interesting.
come to Christ and and my goal was to be a professional golfer at a nice hotel or a nice country club. I wasn't good enough to be on the tour or anything, but maybe have a nice life at a nice hotel or something. Yeah, getting involved in crew and teaching and of course apologetics changed all that. Yeah. Well, let's get into the historical reliability of the New Testament here. People constantly attack the credibility of the New Testament and the Gospels. And it seems like the majority of classes you'll take at a university are often coming from a very liberal perspective. I went to an Episcopal high school here, in Hawaii, and they all taught us that the Gospels were not historically reliable. And why is that? Why is it that, or do you agree that the majority of universities seem to attack or put down the credibility, the historical reliability of the New Testament? Why is that?
Yeah, I won't speak for every major university or anything like that, but I would say since the 1700s, there's this thing called the quest for the historical Jesus. And they wanted to, during the Enlightenment. And so there were some changes going on, especially in Western culture, but they were trying to establish a Jesus who is anything other than what the church described. And so this whole search, no miracles, Jesus isn't divine. How do we? And so they'd go after the sources in which those things are described. And what's interesting, as I was doing I kind of grew up, I'd hear those questions asked, but I didn't know what to make of them. I didn't know if they were true or not true. So I would just kind of sit on them. And I didn't mention this, but like when I went to Liberty, I didn't know Paul wrote half the New Testament. So I just kind of kept those comments at bay, pro and con. But then when I started studying them, and I saw that, that's kind of the heritage in academia, it wants to be critical. And that just is the ethos that's there towards Christianity. Over those past 250 years or so, I believe it's Rob Bowman and Ed Komachevsky, and it might be Daryl Bach, might be the other author, but
Yeah, Dan Wallace, I think.
there's a they've been doing research, and there's this they have a recent book that came out that talks about the quest for the historical Jesus and the problem of history, because evidence remains a thorny thing. It doesn't just disappear because you reinterpret it, because if you have to have this odd interpretation in order to discredit it, well, the next generation doesn't hasn't been indoctrinated into that odd interpretation yet. So the evidence kind of stands firm, especially then you can critically analyze it. Well, what they conclude in their book is after 250 years of constant criticism, attack from a multitude of disciplines, there hasn't been a shred of evidence that disrupts the traditional claims about Jesus. And that's not an insignificant thing. It's been attacked constantly, but it's withstood the test of time, not just in 250 years, but for 2,000 years. And so we do see that. Now, one of the comments that really surprised me was James Charlesworth, who I believe is out of Princeton. He has an article that kind of gives the minimal facts, but for the New Testament, it's kind of interesting. But he goes, this is the consensus among scholars that the Gospels are generally reliable texts. And he starts naming people from different continents. And he goes, there's just too many international authorities for me to mention, but they all recognize a general reliability to the Gospels. So I thought that was interesting because we don't hear that so much.
Right.
So I wanted to equip people to be able to, okay, when you start hearing these things, here's some responses you can have and you can think about. Because why would Charlesworth say that? Why would he make that comment? And then that's kind of what the book unpacks.
You went back to the Enlightenment, which eventually gives rise to the quest for the historical Jesus movement and all that. The thing was that at the Enlightenment, when really the naturalist worldview became dominant, and they began to look at the New Testament more through a naturalistic kind of lens. And you mentioned some of it. There were some presuppositions that they assumed to be true through which they were looking and interpreting the New Testament. Could you tell us some of those? You mentioned a little bit, but some of those presuppositions by which they were looking through the New Testament and therefore, with the critical eye, came to some conclusions that would seem to, what, discredit the Gospels in the New Testament?
Yeah, so and one of them, perhaps one of the most famous, is David Hume, who wrote a short little essay on miracles. And it was really the right book at the right time for skeptics. It got criticized immediately, and several flaws were pointed out when the book came out. But nonetheless, it just is one of those things that was written at the right time, and then people would quote it without, I mean, it has remained up until recently, about 2000, a staple in the quest for the historical Jesus studies. And even today, there's still many people who, although miracles are a lot more discussed because of the works of like Craig Keener, and even Habermas has a book in defense of miracles, and we got Richard Swinburne. Those are some topics that have been an issue because of Hume. So the lack of miracles is one. Another is the idea of revealed religion. That was something that was sort of uncouth to that culture in that time, because they thought we could all just come to God through our reason. Well, not everyone, but a lot of them would think we don't need revealed religion to know these things. And so Jesus being God in the flesh would be quite opposite of that. That would be another one, because it seems to limit what humans can do. And during this period, modernity is starting to come on the rise. Many postmoderns, they rightly identify that theology was replaced with anthropology. So instead of God revealing himself, it's man revealing himself, and man being the dictator and the authority of all things. But then many postmoderns go on to point out, and it was absolute horror as a result. So a lot of bad things happen in that process as well, not just in history, but elsewhere. So those are just some. I mean, there's attacks too against, again, Jesus's deity would be another one. They don't have the evidence that we have now too. Some discoveries, archaeological discoveries, they didn't have back then. Some manuscripts they didn't have back then as well. So I think we've got a lot more now to help highlight why those theories haven't held up.
Yeah. So briefly, how do we know that the miracles in the Gospels actually happened? A lot of scholars will, because they read, as you mentioned, because they read miracles in the Gospels, automatically put it in the area of folklore, like the Upanishads and, the Hawaiian or Greek religions, and automatically throw it in there. What makes the New Testament account of miracles different? And we would say historical rather than in the folklore category.
Yeah, there's a number of different angles, I think, to answer that question. One is the one, I don't want to forget this one, but I'd say the presumption of equivalent evidence. So it just presumes the New Testament is on the same level as the Upanishads. But is it though? Like, we got to look at the case by case basis on that. Buddhism would be another one. Just for example, there's a 400-year gap between when Buddha lived and when we have the writings about his life and teachings. That's a huge gap. We don't have anything like that in the New Testament. So just on evident, they're not all equal evidentially. So we got to do a case-by-case examination of that. And I think we talked about that last time, oh, at SES when we were talking there. Because the evidence for each one is different. But then when it comes to the New Testament, well, how do we know that these miracles happen? I mean, how do we know anything happened in the past? We have certain historical criteria that we do intuitively, unless we got extra time on our hands and we want to study this stuff for academic reasons. Then we break down what that intuition really looks like. And it typically involves things like multiple attestation. Like, because if we see it, if we come upon an event, we don't know exactly what happened. Well, we want to find eyewitnesses. We want to have a number of them if we can. We also want to have reports earlier to the events, not later. No one's going, oh man, I wish we had later sources. I wish we had 400 years after the events. But in addition to that, not all eyewitnesses are even. They're not all equal. Some have more weight and less weight than others. It just depends on the source. And so when it comes to the New Testament and miracles, miracles are just so widely attested both inside and outside the New Testament. We have both friends and enemies reporting Jesus as a miracle worker. Some just attribute it to sorcery, but they're not claiming he did these extraordinary deeds. And so you have people that the evidential case is so strong. You've got someone like Marcus Borg, who's a member of the Jesus Seminar, which rejected like 90% of Jesus's sayings. He says that no matter how difficult miracles may be to the modern mind, on purely historical grounds, they are virtually indisputable. So, what that means is what your presuppositions may be when you look at the case historically, the evidence is there as though it were for any other event. And so, if you want to try to explain them away because of your presuppositions, well, maybe you're forcing your presuppositions on the evidence. And as a historian, that's a no-no. You're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to let the evidence tell you where to go. So it's a pretty powerful quote coming from someone of the Jesus Seminar, but there's many quotes just like that. That Jesus was a miracle worker is widely regarded by scholars.
Yeah, and a lot of that would have to do with the date of the Gospels and the New Testament. Were they written in the lifetime of the eyewitnesses? And that's critical because, historians know it takes over a century for legends to develop. All your eyewitnesses who can corroborate your facts would have to be gone from the scene. And the New Testament, we would argue, is written well within the lifetime of the eyewitnesses. How do we know that?
Yeah, so when I typically talk about this, I'll use the dates that the skeptic Bart Ehrman gives. And he gives 65 for Mark, 80, 85 for Matthew and Luke and John, mid-90s, so 95 AD. And so even within those late dates, they're within the lifetime of the eyewitnesses. Now, with that said, there are atheists and agnostics who date Mark to the 40s AD, quite a bit earlier than 65. There are some others. There's actually, it seemed to me really strange to find this out, but there's only two books written on the dating of the New Testament in the past like 100 years. Only two. And usually where you go to get information on the dating is New Testament introductions or commentaries. So there's only two full-length books on the subject itself. And both of them independently argue that the New Testament was written before 70 AD. Before 70 AD. And of course, at 70 AD was the destruction of the Jewish temple. And so, one of the arguments, this isn't all of them, but just one of them, is that if the temple was destroyed, they would have mentioned it because Jesus is predicting it. And so, why would they leave it as a cliffhanger and not confirm Jesus fulfilled the prophecy? Why make him seem as an apparent, we don't know if this prophecy is going to be fulfilled or not, if it was. And so, that's one element. Just one other example here. Is in Acts, we're left with Paul in jail. So he hasn't died yet. And so most scholars date his death to around the mid 60s under Nero. And so if his martyrdom isn't mentioned in Acts and we're just kind of left with him just sitting in jail and it's kind of like this is where, the letter's ending because this is where we're at in time. Well, that means Acts was written before the mid 60s, which means Luke was written even earlier than that. And if Matthew and Luke use Mark as a source, which a lot of scholars think, well, that meant now all of these are starting to back up even earlier. So that would be another case that can be made. So long story short, though, written within the lifetime of the eyewitnesses, whichever one of those, veins you want to take, all within the lifetime of the eyewitnesses. But we'll see many people today thinking that they're not written until the second century. So we want to be ready to answer that, and also be confident when we hear that and be like, oh, they're not reading the right sources here. And by right sources, I mean guys who are giving arguments. Because I say that, I've got someone in mind who he talks about how he was reading someone who wasn't a New Testament scholar and reported all these dates were second century. It's like, well, go look at the guys. Like, again, Bart Ehrman's not trying to push Christianity, but the reality is the New Testament sources are first century. And so we, as he says, we can and should use them. They are the best sources for the historical Jesus that we have.
Yeah, so like you say, you compare it to like the first biography we have of Buddha. It's about 400 or 500 years after Buddha's life. The first biography we have of Muhammad, it's actually from one guy, Ibn Ishaq, who wrote, hundreds of miles away in the, modern day Iraq and Iran, about 150 years later, we think. But actually, we don't have his biography. We have Ibn Hisham, who took a lot of that material, and even Ibn Hisham says, well, I don't trust a lot of Ibn Ishaq's work, and that's 2 centuries later. So that's different from what we have in the New Testament. These guys wrote in the, generation of the eyewitnesses here, and many of these were indeed first generation eyewitness accounts. So big
Yes, and they're
difference there.
writing right within the lifetime, not just of like friendly eyewitnesses, but antagonist eyewitnesses. And so, and being in the genre of biographies, this is the like this is the best genre they could have written in, because it is a subset of history. The whole point of that genre is to communicate historical, factual, faithful representations of the past. And so that's what they pick. Doing that within the lifetime of eyewitnesses makes that emphasis even more so. So it's very important for those kind of elements. We take the genre for granted oftentimes, but again, if it was written in say, like a myth or a novel category, that would be something that would change how we understand the text, the same way we don't understand Star Trek, the same way we understand a NASA report, right? Two different things. But very important nonetheless.
Yeah, that's a point you bring up here in your book. Trustworthy is the genre. And how did the Jews, view historical accounts? Some people will say, well, they're kind of like the Greeks. They talk about Perseus and the Odyssey, and the Greeks just kind of took for granted, yeah, we throw in some myths and folklore in there, and that's just the way we do history here. Is that how the Jews kind of viewed biography and historical accounts?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Richard Burridge is the one who he's got the classic work on the genre of the Gospels. And one of the most provocative points, it's a very profound point that he makes as well, is there are no biographies of rabbis. Because if you make a biography of a rabbi, that sounds like a violation of the first commandment about you're making an idol, because a biography is telling you and giving you someone as an example to follow after, either a moral example, a courageous example. And so if we're putting a rabbi as someone to follow after, well, we're supposed to follow after God. So why am I following after this rabbi? So the rabbi's teachings would be shared. Obviously, they're sharing those sorts of things, but they do that because they're showing their teachings that help us follow the Torah better, right? So we're not following the rabbi, we're just trying to follow the Torah better. But the Gospels write a biography about Jesus, and they do not see that as idolatry. Because they see, as Burridge states, they see Jesus as the embodiment of the Torah in the flesh. And so doing that was not a violation of the first commandment. It was more so a fulfillment of it. So a really provocative point there theologically. And then the historical point, as we just mentioned, is within the lifetime of eyewitnesses, you and you're writing biographies, you're not allowed to just create things. That was not expected. Right, that's not the typical thing people would have done. So, they're writing within the conventions of their day, they pick the best genre. And of course, Jews were interested in history, but as far as biographies go, more specifically, that's going to change things depending upon if you're writing so in such a way that encourages people to follow you instead of the Lord.
Once again, we've run out of time. Thank you for joining us here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number is 483-0586. Or you may email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit the subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Just log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.